Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Glad to have you listening this morning. This hour, how China is exerting its power internally and around the world and what you'll hear about it during the presidential campaign. On June 30th, China's government hastily and quietly passed a law that will have profound effects on life in Hong Kong. An NYU law professor told the New York Times, all in all, this is a takeover of Hong Kong. It comes as the nation still grapples with the effects of the pandemic that ravaged China's economy and damaged its international reputation. But when the People's Congress opened in late May, Chinese experts say there was an air of celebration over the novel coronavirus as a triumphant Xi Jinping led the ceremonies. Steve Tsang, director of the China Institute in London, said recently they want to remind people in China, just think how lucky you are that you have Xi Jinping and the Communist Party governing you. The message is, imagine what suffering you would have if you have Boris Johnson or Donald Trump as your leader. And speaking of President Trump, even as he has repeatedly talked about how warm his relationship is with the Chinese leader, he has targeted Vice President Joe Biden for not being tough enough on China. And you're going to hear a lot of rhetoric about that in the 2020 campaign. So two guests this morning and your questions. I'd like to know whether your view of China has changed since the pandemic emerged and we saw this news out of Hong Kong. And since we are going to be hearing plenty of rhetoric during the fall campaign, think about what kind of relationship you think an American president should have with China. So give some consideration to the kind of relationship you think the United States and China should have, and then whether your view of China has changed since the pandemic emerged and they moved on Hong Kong. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Our guest this morning, Ankit Panda, is a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists and joining us this morning from New York City. Mr. Panda, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Bonnie Glazer is with us, director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and with us from Reston, Virginia. Ms. Glazer, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Good to be with you.
Ankit Panda, I want to ask you about Xi Jinping and recall that in March 2018, he essentially anointed himself president for life. Does that give him more license to do the kinds of things that he did in Hong Kong at the end of June?
Yeah, so that moment you refer to in 2018 was, I think, certainly seen as significant in that it basically, I think, cemented Xi's position as the most powerful Chinese leader since really Mao Zedong. And the transition that we saw that year was a move in China more explicitly from the era of collective leadership, which was really cemented under Deng Xiaoping, which coincided with China's economic opening up to the world, back to an era of personalized leadership under Xi Jinping. Of course, we don't see a lot of what happens at the highest levels of China's political leadership. It's not a transparent system. We don't know exactly what the other senior leaders around Xi necessarily think of his leadership. We have to assume that there's no open criticism really happening of Xi at this point, given that that's simply not how the Chinese system works. Just a few days ago, a prominent Chinese academic who had very softly criticized Xi Jinping, frankly, was put under arrest. Wow. This is really the environment under which things are happening today in China. But without doubt, I think that was a significant moment that really cemented Xi's position as a iron-fisted Chinese leader.
And was that arrest, did that happen within China or was that within Hong Kong?
That was within China.
Wow. Okay. Bonnie Glaser, I think some context on this law that has been opposed on Hong Kong might be valuable here. Is it aimed directly at the people who were protesting and demonstrating for autonomy from China? And is it indeed legislation that is deliberately vaguely worded so that it can apply to a lot of different situations?
Well, I think that the national security legislation in Hong Kong was in part aimed at preventing a recurrence of the kind of protests that took place in 2019, where millions of people were advocating for democracy on the streets of Hong Kong, and they were desecrating the Chinese flag, the PRC flag. This was seen as unacceptable. Mm-hmm. The Beijing government felt it needed to have a mechanism that it could use to exert control. And I also think looking forward, as there will be elections for the Legislative Council in September, that the Chinese party did not want to lay itself open to the possibility that the pro-China legislators could lose influence and even control of that legislature. So the Chinese just felt, I believe they did an assessment of what the risk was, mm-hmm. And Xi Jinping is more risk tolerant than prior Chinese leaders, and so they decided to pass this legislation and impose it. Yes, it of course it's vague, but Chinese law is always vague. There's definitions in the law of secession and sedition and terrorism. China always interprets these kinds of concepts in whatever way is useful for them at the time. So that's the tradition, I think, of the Chinese legal system. Remember, it is rule by law, not rule of law.
Okay, I'm going to come back on that assessment of risk, but I want to grab a call here from James in Minnetonka. James, as you watch this unfold, what occurs to you about that? What kind of questions come up?
Hi, Carrie. I just have a couple of observations. Mm-hmm. One being, it's a perfect time for China to go in and crack down on Hong Kong while the world is distracted by the pandemic. I mean, it's a brilliant political move. And the other one being, China is on its way to crushing the golden egg that is Hong Kong, or I should say, killing the goose that laid the golden egg. I think there's going to be a flight of people leaving Hong Kong because of the draconian measures that mainland China has imposed on these people. It's just going to crush, I feel at least, it's going to crush this great financial power. Mm. And those are my observations.
Okay, so good. Good. Some things to dig in there. Thank you. Anki Panda, about the economy and how valuable that has been to China, do you think James's assessment is right?
Well, I think it's partly right. I think it actually gets to an important dynamic that we can dig into here. I mean, if we look at the 1997 handover when the UK passed Hong Kong to China with the understanding that Hong Kong would retain a high degree of autonomy under a system of one country, two systems. At that time, if you looked at the percentage of China's total GDP represented by the economic activity happening in Hong Kong, it was around 16% of China's total GDP. Mm. Today, it's under 3%.
Wow.
And that's a significant change in Hong Kong's relative economic importance to China overall. I do think he's right that Hong Kong continues to be a vibrant global city, a major financial hub, a major hub for trade. It's a dynamic city full of expats from around the world. That said, if you're the Chinese Communist Party and you've very publicly stated that your core interests in domestic and international politics include, above all, territorial integrity and preventing what China calls secessionism, then you really aren't going to prioritize whatever economic benefits are to be lost here. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party is also calculating that, as it has seen in other parts of China, for example, cities like Shenzhen, Shanghai, Beijing, which continue to play an important financial role, continue to attract international business, although that might change given things that are happening in China today. I think it calculates that even if it does crack down politically in Hong Kong, the people that will really flee are going to be the politically active, the protesters, and that many in the business community will find a way to stay there, even if they recognize that they no longer have the freedoms necessarily to go out to bars and restaurants and talk about local politics with the freedom that they once used to have. I think it's too early to say whether that calculation is correct, but I do think that going back to what Bonnie said about Xi Jinping's risk tolerance, I think he's calculated that this is a cost that would be worth paying.
Jill says on Twitter, yes, my opinion of China has changed, but not because of the pandemic. Their land grab of Hong Kong is sickening. My heart breaks for the people of Hong Kong with all of the freedoms that have been lost and those that they still stand to lose. Shane says, it seems to me that China has been behaving consistently with what we would expect, i.e. acting predictably. But our administration needs a scapegoat while at the same time not really reacting to what we know about the regime. Failure all around is not China's fault. To the phones to David in Minneapolis. Hi, David. A question for Bonnie and Ankit.
Yeah, good morning. So given that China has this sense of historical greatness and then like post the Beijing Olympics, we've seen, you know, greater sense of like Chinese nationalism, and then just kind of like moving into like kind of almost like neocolonialism into Africa. Do you perceive, or do you think that the U.S.'s relative like a perception on the world right now is kind of being weaker than it has been in recent decades, that makes the Chinese government more bold to kind of step out and do whatever they want, and then try to, you know, kind of take the realm, or the helm, I should say, nationally or internationally?
Yeah, good question. And I'm really glad you brought up China and Africa. We're going to talk about that. So, Bonnie, what would you say to that question?
Well, I think that's a really interesting and important question. It goes to the motives of Xi Jinping and the Chinese leadership. And I believe that there are two factors at work here. One is that the Chinese are fearful of being criticized, not only by their own people, but also the rest of the world for what happened early in the crisis of the pandemic in Wuhan and China's cover-up and failure to provide information that was accurate to the rest of the world. And the Chinese Communist Party, I think, is always very sensitive about its own legitimacy and feels potentially vulnerable, even though Xi Jinping's position is quite strong within the party. So the other side of that coin is taking advantage of opportunities. And Xi Jinping has talked about turning crisis into opportunity. The Chinese did this during the global financial crisis during, you know, 2008 and 2009. And I think that the Chinese see this pandemic as another opportunity presented to China. And of course, it comes on top of policies by the Trump administration of withdrawing from some international institutions, including the World Health Organization, and also weakening, I think, the perception in the world of the U.S. as a leader and the leader of democracy around the world. Right now, democracy and the United States does not look very appealing, not only to Chinese, but to many other countries around the world. And I think that Xi Jinping wants to capitalize on this opportunity.
We're having a conversation about China. I do want to let you know about some developing news here out of the U.S. Supreme Court. The court has decided that Obamacare contraceptive mandates can be weakened, essentially, that they are allowing the expansion of exemptions for employers who have religious or moral objections to contraceptive coverage under the ACA. You'll hear more about that when we get to news. If you've just joined into the conversation, we are talking about China, their ambitions, their move in Hong Kong, their management of the virus, their role in the rhetoric of our 2020 presidential campaign. I think of this as a conversation preparing you in some ways for what you're going to hear the campaigns and the candidates saying about the U.S. relationship with China. So we'll talk with our guests about that. Bonnie Glaser is with us, director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Ankit Panda is a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists. And I'm asking you if your view of China has changed since the pandemic. Perhaps it's hardened. Perhaps you have more dimension to it. and to their move in Hong Kong. And as noted, you're going to be hearing lots of rhetoric about the relationship that the U.S. should have with China in the campaign. What kind of a relationship do you think that ought to be? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Back to the phones here to John in Minneapolis. Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah, I'm curious about what your guests would say to the notion that China right now seems to be acting against, in many ways, against sort of the values of the United States historically. But given the rise of their economy, certainly on our consumer base, and given the fact that technologies like artificial intelligence and quantum computing, which we are presently competing with China relatively quietly, how these things will inform governance worldwide, and if America's representative democracy might actually lag behind an authoritarian and highly intelligent model guided by the Chinese, who's been working on this certainly for the last 40 years materially, and now seems to be really ratcheting up the power dynamic of geopolitics, sort of in the way that the United States did in the 70s and 80s as the Russian sort of threat waned and our economy and our military might allow us to sort of take over certain parts of economies, say in South America or even in Africa, and China now playing that card, but with armed with great technologies.
There's so much there, John. We could probably do the whole hour just on that. Thank you for the question, Anki Panda. Can you tackle it?
Yeah, I'll try to cover as much of that as I can.
Okay.
So I think one of the interesting things that was brought up was China's effect on the American consumer base. And I think this has been an important part of how attitudes towards China have begun to shift domestically. I'll just bring up one example, which was last year, the major tiff between the NBA and China over a tweet, I believe, from a manager of the Houston Rockets who expressed support for Hong Kong independence. By the way, I mean, if he had been tweeting that after the passage of this Hong Kong national security legislation, he would technically have been in violation of that legislation per Article 38 of that law, which actually expands China's authority to cover pro-secessionist, quote, sentiment in Hong Kong to really the entire world, to people outside of Hong Kong. So that's really, again, I think a chilling effect here. But I think Americans are beginning to recognize that there are certain costs associated with the kind of economic interdependence that really for 20 years, successive administrations, Republican and Democrat, pursued with China with the understanding that it would lead to benefits for both sides. And now I think under Xi Jinping, we're beginning to see that that really isn't going to be the case, that China has a fundamentally different set of values, a fundamentally different set of ideas guiding its worldview. And it intends to apply those to the way it manages not only its internal affairs, but its foreign policy. On the issue of technologies and American competitiveness with China, I mean, look, I'm not going to tell you that there aren't things that the United States is doing that are self-defeating here. I mean, just yesterday or just this week, we heard about steps potentially to make it more difficult for international students to come and study in the United States. I mean, when you talk about China's top-down system, and when you talk about technologies like quantum computing and artificial intelligence, yes, it is true that China is the leader, especially in artificial intelligence in many ways, and quantum computing. There are certain areas within those fields where Chinese researchers have put out findings ahead of American researchers. But I will say that there is nothing like Silicon Valley in China, where you have people coming in from around the world, being able to pursue in a rule of law society with free inquiry, ideas and innovation in the way that the United States has supported for years. Of course, this is an advantage that is really ours to lose. And this really requires, I think, the United States taking things like its immigration policy into its own hands as a tool of competitiveness. This is going to be a part of competing with China, that the United States needs to continue to be a place that people around the world can feel like they can come and thrive. And if that changes, I think, your concerns about China maybe taking the leading role in many of these fields, I think will be a better place. But, you know, I'm not ready to write off the United States just yet.
Bonnie, I want to ask you about something that I was reading in Foreign Policy magazine. Now, admittedly, this came out in the early days of the pandemic, I think in the February edition. but it is by a Claremont McKenna professor, Minxin Pei, and they're arguing that essentially the mismanagement at the beginning of the pandemic in China deepened the dissatisfaction with the government. And here's an excerpt. I'm just wondering if this still stands or if Xi is past the worst of this. If Xi continues on this trajectory, eroding the foundations of China's economic and political power and monopolizing responsibility and control, he will expose the CCP to cataclysmic change. Does that seem to be pertinent today, with given what you were saying about the risk assessments that have been made and the decisions that, that they've undertaken?
Early in the pandemic, I do think that there were signs that the Chinese leadership was being criticized. We even had a member of the 25-member Politburo that leads China. Her name is Sun Chunlan, went to Wuhan and was met by catcalls of don't believe everything that you see. This is not really real here. You are being shown things that are fake. And this was actually put out on Chinese media.
Wow.
I even saw a video of this on Twitter, which makes you wonder why the Chinese Communist Party itself was telling the world that Chinese leaders and the party are being criticized. So this was a very fragile moment, I think, for the Chinese leadership. But fast forward to today, I think that the critics have been snuffed out. Indeed, of course, some of the doctors that tried to make the Chinese public aware of what was going on, one in particular died, and and the Chinese government embraced him as a hero very quickly because they knew that the Chinese public supported him, and that was an adroit move. That said, I do think that the vast majority of Chinese look at what is going on in the United States and other countries, the very large number of deaths and cases, and they are being told by their own propaganda that, yes, they have done a much better job. They've used draconian measures that may not have been acceptable to democracies, but they probably have wiped out in large part the virus and prevented it from spreading. And so I think, yes, there's fragility. There's always criticism of the party. But Xi Jinping has made sure nobody can get online and criticize the party. Nobody can organize. And so the threats to the system are not really that apparent, and they're not as great as I think that they may have been in those early months in January and February.
I see. Hayana says on Twitter, not really, even after the new Hong Kong security law and the ongoing atrocities against the Uyghurs. Her opinion hasn't changed. She says what's becoming apparent, though, is that made in China is beginning to signify complete immunity for the CPC. Forget freedom and human rights as long as China supplies the world. Anki Panda, would you respond to that? Is that mostly true?
I think it was true for a moment. Human rights concerns have always been a part of the American diplomatic agenda with China, but they've been subservient to other means. And I think today we really need to ask ourselves, when we look at what is essentially a massive effort of cultural genocide in an Alaska-sized part of China in the country's west, how much longer can we essentially allow economic interdependence with China to constrain the options that the United States has? And this is a very difficult question. It's easy for us to basically say that, you know, what is happening in Xinjiang is really as bad as what happened in Germany in the 1930s, and that we need to take similar steps. But really, where does that take us when it comes to our options in managing China? And this is something I think a lot more people are thinking about. It's part of the reason why I think in the United States you are seeing a bipartisan sense that American policy towards China needs to turn towards taking these issues head on. And certainly the Hong Kong national security legislation, I think, also contributes to that. There is a lot of talk right now of economic decoupling. What does that mean? It basically means that the United States would work towards reducing the interdependencies that we've built with China over two decades, because a lot of folks who work in these spaces recognize that those interdependencies constrain our options. It constrains the options in the sense that, you know, we have many interests that inform our political processes here in the United States, including private companies and firms. And many of them simply aren't ready for the United States and China to go into a protracted period of geopolitical conflict over these issues that will manifest with economic consequences. That's been a big change in the last few years, is that whatever differences the United States had with China, including over areas including the South China Sea, human rights, over North Korea policy, all of that would remain insulated from the broader economic relationship. Under the Trump administration, that has no longer been the case. And I think that's something that's actually going to outlast the Trump administration. But absolutely, it is something that I think is at the center of contemporary debates about U.S.-China relations.
I mean, when you think about what John Bolton reveals in his book about how the president was basically a supplicant to the president of China, right? Please buy more agricultural supplies. Please buy more soybeans from the Midwest, our state included, so that I can get reelected. You don't see, I mean, if that all of that is right, any kind of a move to holding China accountable. You see the United States saying we desperately need your buying power.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, frankly, I think there is this idea that President Trump is hard on China. And I think, you know, we certainly see that publicly from the administration and certain things that they do and say. But it's not only those revelations, but other steps as well. You know, for example, at the height of the Hong Kong protests last summer, President Trump very publicly said that, you know, he thought what Xi Jinping was doing to Hong Kong was right. And I think these things will have costs longer term for American moral credibility and leadership. I mean, these are things that we're going to need going forward to deal with China. And certainly it won't help when the Chinese point to an American president that has dealt with them in this way.
Yeah. Let me grab a call here from Doug in Winona. Doug, it sounds like you're curious about the South China Sea. I think we just mentioned that.
Well, you didn't get to the real nub of the question.
Right. What is that?
So somebody sent two American carrier groups into the South China Sea. And my question is, who's going to fire the first shot, either accidentally or on purpose?
Bonnie, how volatile is this confrontation in the South China Sea?
Well, the conflict, if you will, that takes place, the competition in the South China Sea, is on various levels, and it's really primarily, I think, between China and the other claimants. So you have Vietnam and the Philippines and Malaysia, even Taiwan and Brunei, that all have claims in these waters. And China is using not so much military vessels, but law enforcement ships that prevent countries from exploiting energy that is rightfully theirs in their 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zones. This is particularly true with Malaysia and Vietnam. This is something that I think the United States is trying to stand up for these countries and has said so rhetorically under the Trump administration. And then another layer is enforcing freedom of navigation, so ships being able to sail anywhere where international law allows. And frankly, this was done under the Obama administration, not just under the Trump administration. And there is a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. The Chinese are conducting a huge military exercise this week in the northern part of the South China Sea, and the United States has two aircraft carrier battle groups there for the first time since 2014. I don't think either country really seeks a conflict. I doubt we will see a major use of military force. But I agree with your questioner that there is a risk of inadvertent collision, for example. Your listeners may remember that in 2001, we had a collision between a U.S. fighter jet, a Chinese fighter jet, sorry, and a U.S. Reconnaissance aircraft called an EP-3. The Chinese pilot lost his life. The U.S. plane made a just miracle landing on Chinese soil on Hainan Island. That kind of an accident certainly could happen again. It could escalate between it could become a wider war between the two countries, Or both sides could, as they did in 2001, find political ways to defuse the situation. I don't think that a war serves either Chinese or U.S. interests in the South China Sea, but I don't rule out the potential for an accident.
Bonnie Glaser with us from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Anki Panda with us from the Federation of American Scientists. We're going to get a look at the latest news. When we come back, one of the things that I want to ask our guests about is when you cut through a lot of the blustering and the tit for tat over the trade war, I'd like to know how they'd characterize the true relationship between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump. And then whether, if there is a change in administrations, what kind of understanding or reset, if necessary, should be undertaken by the next president, who, if there's a change in administrations, would presumably be Joe Biden. So we'll ask our guests to think about the political implications of this and the geopolitics of it. Ankit Panda with us, senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists. Bonnie Glaser with us, director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I promised Ed to get to him right on the other side of news. Ed, thanks so much for waiting through the newscast. Much appreciated.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. Yeah, interesting. Lately, I've been thinking about the issue of sanctions, because we apply sanctions to so many other countries, but you never hear any discussion about applying sanctions to China as opposed to, you know, our tariff wars, and what significant difference there is, or why, in fact, we don't hear policy discussions about applying sanctions to China for the things that they're doing that we apply against other nations for.
And Ankit Panda, is that true, that we have many more sanctions against Russia and Iran?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, you know, sanctions are one of the favorite tools in the U.S. foreign policy toolkit. I think for a good reason, which is that oftentimes responding to certain things with military force simply isn't practical, but the United States is interested in imposing costs for behaviors that it deems to be unacceptable, like the 2014 seizure of Crimea from Ukraine by Russia, for example, or in the case of Iran and North Korea pursuing nuclear weapons. And so sanctions are imposed. And increasingly, I think we're beginning to see that with China, over human rights concerns, over Hong Kong, over what's happening in Xinjiang, over the Uyghurs. But, you know, sanctions with China are only capable of going so far, right? I mean, for sanctions to truly have a major effect, the United States would have to contemplate serious cost imposition measures like cutting China off from the U.S. financial system. And I shouldn't have to tell you that would have dramatic effects for the global economy. And on the flip side, you know, we talked a little bit earlier on the show about how China reacts to cost imposition strategies. I think the answer is that under Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party's leadership, there are certain economic costs that China is willing to pay for when it comes to topics like its sovereignty and its internal affairs. So sanctions only work when we're willing to use them as a means of conditioning the behavior of another country. And with China, I'm afraid that while we can do that to, you know, maybe sleep a little bit better at night over you know, sanctioning some of these Chinese officials who are involved in awful human rights violations, at the end of the day, is it going to change Chinese behavior? I'm personally skeptical.
I want to ask you this question because I know you have to leave here in just a couple minutes before I get Bonnie's view. So how would you characterize the true relationship between the leaders of China and the United States? Is it a fruitful relationship in any way? What would you say about it?
Well, I think President Trump's leadership, relationship with President Xi falls into a pattern that I think we've seen with other leaders, and specifically other authoritarian leaders, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, North Korean Chairman Kim Jong-un, where he has a begrudging respect, or not begrudging in many ways even. I think he has a true respect. I mean, from John Bolton's book, we learned that apparently Trump told Xi to his face that he thought he was the greatest Chinese leader in 300 years, which I'm sure was just music to Xi Jinping's ears. And I think on some level, there is a sincere degree of admiration that Xi Jinping doesn't have to deal with a free media and can simply use his iron-fisted role to change national affairs as he pleases. Of course, I think when it comes to the election and national politics, the Trump administration is doubling down on an anti-China message. That, however, doesn't tell us much about the president's personal relationship with the Chinese leader. I think it simply tells us that American views about China are changing, and they're changing in a way that I think the administration thinks will be useful in this election campaign.
Thank you so much for being with us this morning. Really good to have your insight. Much appreciated.
Thank you for having me. Sorry, I have to run early.
No, we understand. Ankit Panda from the Federation of American Scientists. Okay, Bonnie, and then I would add this element to the question. How much does the personal relationship between the leaders of the United States and China really matter?
The personal relationship between the U.S. president, leaders of any country in the world, particularly a rising superpower that has different definitions or visions of the world order, how it wants to change the world order in its favor and introduce norms that are contrary to democratic norms. I mean, I think this relationship is incredibly important. And the most important piece of that relationship, I believe, is credibility. When a U.S. president says something, you want that leader to believe it. We had an instance in the South China Sea where, frankly, the Obama administration wasn't being very tough with China when China was building artificial islands in the South China Sea. But then apparently President Obama did in one conversation say, if you take this next step, and he was very clear about what that was, that there would be very severe consequences, and the Chinese did not do that. Personally, I wish he had done that earlier. We've seen cases like this with prior presidents, like George W. Bush, when he told the Chinese leader that he was going to go to the opening ceremony of the Olympics, even though he was being criticized at home. But he said at the same time, I am going to support a congressional medal for the Dalai Lama. Hmm. And so other leaders need to know that whatever a president says, they can bank on. And I think we have a problem with President Trump because he says things and then he is contradictory or his administration decides to do something else because he doesn't really care very much about the issue with human rights, Hong Kong. In Xinjiang, he basically told Xi Jinping, well, I support your idea essentially of having what is basically concentration camps to house these Uyghurs and Kazakhs and other Muslims. And this was, of course, from John Bolton's book. So I think we have a problem with a president who doesn't have a high level of credibility, and his top priority appears to be narrowing the bilateral trade deficit with China and not addressing some of the other challenges that we face.
Call here from Hussein in St. Paul. Hi, good morning, Hussein. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
To get started, I just want to say that I completely condemn China's human rights violations and support Hong Kong protesters. But I think it's a little hypocritical and kind of a colonial mindset to think that what China is doing to Hong Kong is very different from what the U.S. continues to do, taking away their autonomy. I'm thinking about like Puerto Rico and recent years where we have taken away all economic freedom from them and imposed these restrictions on what they can spend money on, slashing money they want to spend on education after their recent economic struggles. It just seems that some of these colors have this very anti-China mindset, but don't really can't really back that up with, you know, consistency across these different situations, especially in regards to what we've been doing.
I mean, I think you're responding to the land grab use of the phrase in one of the tweets, but I also think you would agree that Puerto Ricans have all kinds of rights, including the right to dissent, that apparently now the people of Hong Kong do not have.
And that's true, but I think you also have to consider that by all means, China owns Hong Kong, and through a treaty that was imposed upon them, you know, they had this system set up.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would never expect ourselves to be held to that kind of standard, that if another country said that we have to give one of our territories 100 years of autonomy that we would necessarily follow through with that, with, you know, just keeping quiet.
What, Bonnie, what do you think?
Well, I think that China did make commitments in 1997, and we're now only 23 years into that commitment, because China is supposed to preserve one country, two systems, and the autonomy of Hong Kong until 2047. And the fact that China is not honoring that commitment, whether it should have made it or not, is not the issue here. It did, and now it is reneging on those commitments. And although I'm not an expert on what the United States is doing in Puerto Rico, and I'm sure there are many things to criticize, I certainly agree with you, Carrie, that this is a case where people in Hong Kong who have in the past just been able to have peaceful protest, the first person arrested under the new national security legislation was standing with a sign that just said Hong Kong independence. Mm-hmm. And that was enough for that person to be arrested. I'm sure that anybody in Puerto Rico can say or publish anything that they want to say. And I celebrate the right of people who live in democracies all around the world to criticize their government, because it brings the accountability to governments when people are able to criticize them. And occasionally leads to changes in policies. And China has taken that away in Hong Kong and has never given those rights to its own citizens.
A couple questions for you about the rhetoric that we're going to hear during the campaign. It seems that given some of the ads that the Trump campaign has put out, that they're going to make an argument that President Trump is tough on China in a way that Vice President Biden will not be. I would like to arm our listeners for some context when we really start to, you know, to see the campaign fire up in September. What should we understand about what the President Trump will be saying and what may be a different approach, or, I don't know, similar from Vice President Biden if he's elected?
Well, I'm glad that you've raised this, because Ankit was talking earlier about the negativity in American opinion toward China. And just to attach some numbers to that, the Pew Research Center polls showed that unfavorable views of China went from 47% in 2018 to 60% in 2019. And then this year, up to 66%. That's an all-time high. And so President Trump and Vice President Biden are both going to try to tap into this negativity. And I think that Biden sees Trump as weak on China and vulnerable, but Trump also and his campaign strategists see potentially that Biden is going to be vulnerable on China. And so, yes, I agree with you. This is going to be really central in the campaign, to the extent that foreign policy is an issue, although, of course, the China issue connects to some of our domestic issues and economics and trade. But I think that Vice President Biden will be pushing some ways that his policies would be different. And I think that he has the personal experience of having met with Xi Jinping dozens of times when he was vice president. And Xi Jinping, in fact, was also then vice president of China. So he knows him personally. He has had experience dealing with China from inside the government. I think particularly Biden will say that the United States cannot deal with these challenges from China alone. And I think that he will argue that he will take on China in more effective ways, more targeted ways, that he will not withdraw from international organizations, that he will strengthen our alliances, because we need to work together with other countries if we are going to protect democracy and our values around the world and the interests of the United States. And I think that he would also establish effective dialogue mechanisms. One of the problems today with the Trump administration, I believe, is that we have very few regular mechanisms that we talk with China to work out our differences. This is in the military as well as diplomatic and economic and trade realms. And as a result, we end up with things like more carriers in the South China Sea. So we really do need to have more effective ways where we can sit down with the Chinese and work out some of our differences through dialogue, or at least reduce misunderstanding and the potential for miscalculation, because that's really quite dangerous. So I think that Vice President Biden will put out some of his own ideas of the more effective policies to try to push back against the challenges and threats that we see from China. And lastly, I would say that I think that Vice President Biden's own perspectives on China changed dramatically over the years that he was in the White House. And he saw that some of President Obama's light touch on China really didn't work. The Chinese took advantage of weakness and vulnerabilities. So I think we're going to see a tougher set of policies if Vice President Biden is elected.
That's really interesting. So he saw the way President Obama approached this and learned from it. And will depart, I think you're saying, a bit from it. Yeah?
Yes, I think that we will see an evolution. And some of the statements we have seen coming from Vice President Biden, I think, demonstrate that, where his statements about what the Chinese are doing in Xinjiang, what they're doing in Hong Kong, he has said that he would impose sanctions on companies that are from China that have undermined the autonomy of Hong Kong. So, yes, we have to see in what ways he would follow through on these. But his statements are quite tough, and I don't think they're just intended to gain votes, although that is certainly one of the goals that he hopes to achieve. But I think he's also signaling that he will pursue a very tough set of policies, but that are much more effective in shaping Chinese behavior potentially.
Bonnie, this was really interesting. Thanks so much for your help. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Bonnie Glazer is the director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!